Conscious Curiosity SD, where successful San Diego leaders share their stories of leading beyond profit and are using the influence of business to positively change the companies and communities we all work and live in. I'm your host, Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership, a proven and powerful process for unlocking the full potential of the people and teams across your organization, giving you the competitive advantage in the marketplace. We want to thank our collaborative community of business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Business for Good, Cause San Diego, and Be Local. We're all focused on impacting our community of San Diego through the work they do as business leaders. Welcome to the show.
When people talk about the differences between leading a for-profit and a nonprofit, they often think the two worlds are miles apart. But in my experience, there's really only one significant distinction. In my first encounter with today's guest years ago, when he spoke at a morning event on purposeful leadership, he brilliantly highlighted the key difference. A successful founder and leader of multiple for-profit companies, he stated, "Nonprofits require the same level of dedication, hard work, and perseverance as launching a for-profit venture. The challenges are intense. But here's the catch. At the end of the day, there's no equity, no financial windfall for all that hard work. These leaders are driven purely by their passion for the cause, not by the promise of profit." Ken Davenport, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here.
You struck me that morning when you said all that good stuff. I went, yeah, there's the difference.
That was a great quote. I'd forgotten I said that.
Yeah, we'll give you credit for that one. Stuck with me all these years, because that was years ago, actually.
Yeah.
Ken is the co-founder and CEO of Mission Edge, a social enterprise that helps social entrepreneurs and nonprofits focus on their mission. Mission Edge services enable their clients to reach their organizational potential and do more good. Since 2012, they have served more than 1,000 organizations of all sizes and all sectors, helping to build long-term sustainable business models for maximum impact in the community. So, Ken, I'm very excited to revisit that story because I know you've done some for-profit work and then all of a sudden had heart and said, oh, wait a minute, I want to go do something different in life, and here you are today. So,
yeah. Well, thank you. It's been a journey. Hard to believe it was 12 years ago that we started Mission Edge with just a kernel of an idea. I was a partner at San Diego Social Venture Partners. Had left my last company, was kind of bouncing around trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, and knew that I wanted to do something that had some impact.
Ready for some meaning, huh?
Yeah, ready for some meaning. And I really had felt very empty with the last company that I had started and left kind of in the middle of it. Was doing fine, but I just kind of woke up. I had what I often call my obituary moment, the way I think about it. And I was actually reading the Wall Street Journal and reading an obituary about a guy who had lived an amazing life. And I thought to myself, man, my obituary, I don't know if it's going to say necessarily what I want it to say in terms of the mark that I left on the world. And I knew then that I just had to use the next 20, 25 years to do something with more meaning. And I had no idea what that was. Wasn't even really sure what I was passionate about or, you know, even really cared enough about to work on. So Social Venture Partners was a very good training ground. It's a lot of business folks who get together to help the nonprofit community. And we kind of had a kernel of an idea that a lot of the organizations we were working with were phenomenal, passionate, very good programmatically, very solid in terms of their theory of change. But their business, the business side of the organization, was getting in the way of them being successful. Really, they weren't able to raise money because their financials didn't really look very good. You know, they were having continual problems with people, hirings and firings and lawsuits and things, just because they just didn't really know that doing business in California requires...
Not easy here.
Not easy,
sure.
Yeah. Hyper-intense sort of focus on compliance and regulatory environment. It was just very distracting. And I thought, you know, these are business problems I think are not complicated. They just require a certain focus. And none of these organizations had enough money to spend on hiring the right person internally. But I thought if we could hire the right person, then farm them out to four or five different organizations.
Spread the cost around a little bit, right?
They could pay for what they needed and that's it. And we would be responsible for hiring the right people and ensuring quality. So that's how the model got started. Really just starting doing accounting initially and not doing it very well in the beginning, actually. Really struggling to figure out the right model of how much do you charge and what can you pay your people and kind of trying to figure out that equation. But we finally did figure it out. And then we added HR, which we've got a very vibrant, growing practice and just helping nonprofit organizations with all things people from payroll to benefits to you know, organizational
That's another big thing in California, right? Keeping up with HR is not an easy task.
Very
for sure.
hard, very, very costly. And the cost of noncompliance, of course, is severe. So, and then we do fiscal sponsorship as well. So fiscal sponsorship is where a program can come and operate under Mission Edge's umbrella, not be their own 501c3, and raise money and do work in the community basically under us. So it's actually when people come and say to me, you know, hey, I really want to start a nonprofit, and this is what I'm thinking, I immediately say, no, you don't want to start a nonprofit. Please don't do that.
One more. How many do we have?
Yeah, we got 12,000 in San Diego.
That's amazing, right?
And most of them are non-active or very small. And, you know, the reality is that running a nonprofit, as I said in that quote, is very hard. The business model is challenging. So I say to people, don't start a nonprofit. Like, don't go through that whole legal and regulatory and organizational thing if you don't really know up front that you're going to be successful. Do a fiscally sponsored project. You can set up in a week. You can close up in a week. There's no legal trail. You do it under us. We handle your banking and your insurance and all the HR operations.
Almost kind of like prototype your idea, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like
proof of concept.
Yeah, I call it kind of a nonprofit in a box kind of concept.
Yeah.
So we've been doing that for 8 years. It's been a big practice for us. And then we have a little, so we're a social enterprise. We charge fees. They're below market, but we charge fees to our clients for the services that we do. And then we have kind of a philanthropic arm called the Impact Lab, where we raise money from philanthropy to help the small business community. That started in about 2017, 2018. And then it got really big around COVID when small businesses were struggling to figure out, you know, how do I sustain myself? What's my business model? And we partnered with the city of San Diego to provide very focused financial modeling boot camp. Basically, it's a 10-week kind of accelerator program for small businesses, mostly low to moderate income founders, founders of color in underserved areas of San Diego. And we provide them with we assign them a CFO and we provide them with just some deep dive. Hey, here's how you make money. You know, here are the things you should be focusing on. Here's the financial model that you can kind of focus on to kind of grow your business. And we've done more than 200 organizations, 200 companies through that program.
Is that a one-on-one or more of a group kind of?
It's all one-on-one. Yeah, what we found was we did a lot of research in the accelerator market, and there's tons of accelerators all over the place. And the group for finance stuff, the group learning doesn't really work. Every business is unique. Mm. They're all in a different place. They all have their own personal financial issues and, you know, things that they've got to like work through. And it really can only be done one-on-one.
So it's not a basic, here's a quick study on financials for a company. It's more of like, let's dig in and see where you're at, trying to do, what kind of problems you got.
Yeah, we call it a no-guilt zone because
no one wants to own up to
that. Yeah, it's like we're all imperfect and, you know, we've all started companies and everything, you know, starts out a mess. So let's just put that on the table. And we just really get people to open up and we really dig into the details of their lives and of their business and try to figure out how do we match their personal goals with the business and how do we get them making more profit so they can start to pay themselves and start to get out of the low to moderate income tax bracket, essentially.
So it's really kind of looking similar for both organizations, both profit and nonprofits. Like, okay, you got this great idea, you got some passion for doing something, but now how do you turn that into a business?
Yeah, and really the focus really for Mission Edge has always been around sustainability. How do you create a sustainable model? Many nonprofits have what I think is a tough to sustain business model. If it's based on philanthropy, it's every year you're starting at zero and you're
hopeful every year.
Yeah, and some folks have multi-year grants and stuff, but funders, you know, always, when I got into this nonprofit world, the thing that was most bizarre to me is that funders would say, well, I'll fund you for a year or two, and then I want you to go away and find other funders because I don't want you to be dependent on me. But the whole model is dependence, right? The model is like, I need money from you to do the work in the community.
Because the service doesn't typically make money, right?
Exactly.
Right.
So if the program's successful, why would you turn me away and not fund me in perpetuity if I'm doing good work? So there was a lot of really interesting sort of distortions in the nonprofit funding model that I looked at and said, this is not sustainable. It doesn't make any sense. Nonprofits have very little transparency in terms of their funding. So for instance, and I use this example a lot when I started Mission Edge, you know, when I was raising money in the for-profit world, you got immediate feedback. You were doing pitches in front of investors. You got immediate feedback. Like they either liked it or didn't like it. They wanted to know more. You thought you could, you know, kind of read the tea leaves and figure out, okay, this might go someplace. the nonprofit world, mostly you're sending out grant applications into the ether.
Right.
And then you're waiting around for 6 to 9 months to get an answer. Right. And then they say no. And you don't even remember that you even applied to the grant. It was so long ago. And there's no feedback. You don't know why you were turned down. It's a very hard model to sustain. And Mission Edge, you know, as a social enterprise and really with an earned revenue model, you know, we really like to try to teach nonprofits to have more control over their funding. And if you can earn money by doing a service and getting paid for it, we like to promote that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Get a little control over your future that way.
Exactly.
But typically the kinds of services are doing it for people that don't have money kind of thing, or situations that are lacking funding. That's why they're showing up to help out.
Yeah.
Right?
So some models don't work for the participant to pay, but others may pay on behalf of the participant. There's ways of trying to figure out, is there something that I can do? Yeah, and many social enterprises or many nonprofits with an earned revenue stream, they make money doing something completely unrelated to the service, but they're able to kind of utilize that to provide funding for their programs. It's not a panacea. It's not, you know, you can't flip a switch. Just like with any business, there's no easy route to it. But, you know, anything you can do to diversify your revenue,
right,
I think is helpful.
So I know my wife's model, where she's the executive director of Shoreline Community Services, right? So they got the drop-in center for the homeless, but then they also have the care crew that's out doing work, right? So she's hiring the homeless to go out and do street cleaning,
yep,
events set up, those kinds of good things. Not some big cash cow, but it also helps with your fundraising. Like, oh, you know, those are our guys, right? So
exactly,
you're supporting that as well. But at the same time, you know, they're making a little bit of money over there. So it's a good model.
Yeah.
Love that. So let me a little bit more about you. Like, what's your background? How did you get here?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm an entrepreneur when I think about it. I started my first company right out of UCSD in the early 90s now. And that was a spectacular failure, actually, to be honest. It's something that I learned a lot about. I raised a bunch of money from pretty significant local investors.
So you had a good idea.
I had a good idea, or what I thought was a good idea. I had two partners.
We were a hell of a salesman, one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were riding kind of the wave of healthcare technology that was starting to become more and more computerized, not web-based yet, because this was before the internet, really. But we developed a technology to capture, compress, and store MRI and CAT scan images and reduce the cost of storage and retrieval for imaging centers. Super interesting idea. People love the concept.
Were you a tech guy? I mean,
I wasn't really a tech guy. I was really just kind of looking for something to do where I could, you know, kind of start something. And at the time, I considered myself relatively unemployable because I just didn't really want to work for someone else. Kind of got that from my dad, I guess. And this was just an idea. I had a friend in college whose dad was a radiologist, and we found this piece of technology and thought, what could we apply it to? And he says, well, my dad's a radiologist. Let me talk to him about images. And that just kind of led, one thing led to the next. We raised, you know, $3 or $4 million here. And boy, that blew up pretty spectacularly. And I was the only one left standing at the end and shepherded through bankruptcy and had to face investors. And, you know, and I thought really that I'd have to move. I didn't know that.
You'd get out of town?
Yeah, I didn't know I'd be able to stay in San Diego. I thought, oh, I ruined my reputation.
Yeah, really.
But it turns out that wasn't the case because, you know, I tried to do things ethically and tried to kind of own up to our mistakes and realized that the mistakes I made, I would never make again. And I think at some level as an entrepreneur, that's kind of a badge of honor, you know?
I think people in the investing world actually look for that. Some people have had some failures and had a few learnings because you actually know something now versus, oh, I don't know, just worked out. It was all super easy.
And we showed that we didn't know anything because we made all the mistakes that, you know, you would not make today, right? We had an extremely long development cycle. We didn't talk to customers till we'd spent like 2/3 of our money.
Well, this is what you want.
Yeah. I mean, it was just a nightmare. Like, I look back on it now and I think, oh, this is what not to do, basically.
Well, that's what's led to what you're doing today, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I moved on from that and started another couple of companies, went to work in the Bay Area during the dot-com boom and bust for a consulting firm up there and kind of saw the rise and fall of the dot-com era. That was very interesting. And then got into data analytics and started trying to create value out of a lot of the data that a lot of these systems that companies have been implementing, ERP systems and supply chain systems, there was a lot of data. And so got into the business intelligence world, started a company implementing business intelligence software around the country. And that's what I was doing at the end. I'd done a few other things in between, some smaller startups that are still around, but I didn't stay with long term. And then that's the company that I left in 2010 when I decided I was ready to do something else.
So what was that kind of that feeling? Because, you know, we're kind of talking to other leaders like yourself that are out there doing something. It's like, what, maybe the obituary one morning, but what kind of led to the transition?
I mean, I think I was just getting acutely aware of the passage of time. And this kind of leads a little bit into some of the work I've been doing recently on Stoicism, which maybe we'll talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
But I started thinking about mortality and just thinking about, you know, what is our time on Earth and what are we supposed to be doing with it? And
did you have a moment? Was there a health thing or someone in your life, something happened that triggered that, or just kind of a general?
Yeah, not really. I just think generally, I've always had some, my wife says, existential dread. So I've always kind of had these questions about, like, why am I here? And, like, what's the purpose of all this kind of thing? And
it's a good thing to have, Ken, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it is good if you can channel it into something that's positive, right? And so rather than just lament it, I remember going to my wife and saying, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't really. It was funny. I said to her, I don't like my partners. I don't like my customers. I don't like my employees.
Other than that, it's great.
Other than that, I'm having a great time. And she said, well, you know, then quit. Like, quit and find what you really want. And I was in a fortunate position where I could afford to take some time off and kind of, you know, do that sort of wandering process where I just wasn't really sure. And it was scary. It was the first time in my life that I hadn't been doing something that I knew, you know, working towards something. And actually the goal was to do as little as possible and try to embrace the stillness, as they
say. Clear the deck for a moment and see what might pop up.
Yeah, exactly. And not be inundated with kind of inputs all the time. And it was hard to do that. It was a little easier to do that at the time. It was 2010, it was before the iPhone. So, you know,
so fewer distractions.
Yeah, fewer distractions.
Just the Wall Street Journal actually wasn't paper.
Yeah, exactly. And I really wasn't sure what all this was going to amount to, really.
Did you go, like, talk to some people? Did you take a trip? What did that look like for you?
Well, I did a lot of kind of cups of coffee. I would reach out on LinkedIn to different people and said, hey, I'd like to know more about what you do. I was just trying to figure out, like, what's out there. Mm-hmm. Social Venture Partners was very helpful, kind of got me clued in. And that came from a random conversation with someone that I reconnected with over coffee, actually, and said, hey, you should try, you should look at SVP. That might be a good place for you to start. And then I got connected.
So that's when you got plugged in. You'd actually walked away and then went.
Yeah, that's when I got plugged in. It took about 6 months.
So I thought maybe you already were part of that when.
No, actually, I wasn't.
After that.
Yeah, and I remember writing SVP down and looked it up. And I went to a meeting. They said, well, come to a meeting. We're having a get-together. And I did that. It felt good to me. And then that's where I got connected to the veteran community. So I do a lot of work, mostly in my spare time. Mission Edge does a lot of work with veteran service organizations. But for me personally, I've been working with veterans in their military transition to the civilian world.
It's going to be really difficult.
And that's kind of, through SVP, I got connected to the veteran community and found that I was very passionate about helping that community. In particular, back then in 2010, 2011, you know, the multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a lot of pressure on the community and a lot of folks who just needed help. And that's kind of where I sort of found my personal sort of passion project.
Yeah. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. So it was good. And it's evolved. You know, it's funny. Every entrepreneur who's had some success will have people come and say, God, it's so great what you built. I can't believe how it really all fits together and it all makes so much sense. And I think to myself, this is like divine intervention that it looks the way it does. Like, I didn't plan it that way. It just evolves, right? So it makes you look, you know, like you've done something brilliant.
Or 20 years later, all of a sudden, oh, look how successful we are.
Exactly.
Yeah, you should have seen it 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's funny because, you know, you kind of evolve into it and it becomes something that maybe you never even imagined that it would become. But if you stick with it long enough and you bring the right values to the table, you know, good things tend to happen.
Yeah, it's funny how that works that way, yeah?
Yeah.
There is no magic. There's no instant, like, oh, just do A, B, C, and somehow it all works out.
Yeah,
good luck with that. Life isn't designed for that. We're here to learn, apparently.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I work with a lot of young entrepreneurs and teach a lot of entrepreneurship. And, you know, one of the things that I try to just convince them of is that story that you've heard about somebody writing something down in a napkin, sitting in a coffee shop in the Silicon Valley and raising $5 million, and the rest is history. Like, that's lore, right? That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, startups are hard and the process is hard and you have to have a lot of fortitude to overcome the obstacles in front of you.
I think that's part of the problem, right? Somehow this gets romanticized, or what the right word is for that, or we see some movie or, oh, that's what it all, that, simple as that. Well, that's like one in a million that actually looks like that. And But even those shows, you know, like the Uber story, like, you know, the ups, the downs, the craziness of it all. And
yeah. Well, because you don't see the backstory or all the meetings they took where people told them they were crazy and this will never amount to anything. And, you know, you say, okay, and you go to the next meeting and, you know, you just keep going. If you really believe in it, you find someone who's willing to kind of stake you and give you a chance to prove it. But there are no overnight success stories.
It's like the books. You see some guy that wrote a book that has this bestseller, and you find out, yeah, I went to like 30, 40 different publishers before finally suddenly said, oh, and you go, really?
Exactly.
This is an amazing book. Yeah. How come they kept passing on this thing?
Yeah, and it's amazing how much luck plays in the equation. I'm often amazed at, you know, most success stories have one or two inflection points where they were just happen to meet the right people, be in the right place at the right time. Have somebody see something that had some influence that was able to recommend that. You couldn't have designed that. It just kind of happened. Now, they had happened because they didn't give up and they were in the arena, like, trying to make it work. But every success story has a certain luck piece to it that just sort of
is something just, showed up at the right time.
It was kismet that, you know, this person saw this thing and then happened to know this person, and that person happened to be able to introduce me to, you know, the publisher of my book or whatever. And I think every story has some story like that.
I was reading this book. It's called Surrender. And I can't remember the guy's name at the moment here, but it starts out in the beginning. He's flying in a private jet to go sell his billion-dollar company. Right. So that's like the beginning. And then you start back to like, he's living in the woods, you know, doing this thing, which one thing leads to another. It's this whole story of like, I just kept letting go. I just kept letting go. I just kept stepping into whatever's like presenting itself. And yeah, it's kind of a crazy story of leading life in a little different way. So yeah, stoicism a little bit. How did you get into that? And maybe talk to the crowd a little bit about what is that?
Yeah.
I've done a little reading on that, so I don't know much, but I find it intriguing.
Yeah, I sort of fell into it, to be honest. I was about 4 or 5 years ago was kind of going through a period of sort of questioning what I was doing again and kind of trying to, you know, I have an 18-year-old son and we were going through a rough patch at home. And I was trying to figure out, like, what are some tools that I can use to kind of get myself straight on what all these things that were going on. Mission Edge was struggling at the time, and it was just pre-COVID, and it was like there was just a whole bunch of stuff happening. And I realized that I was kind of lacking certain tools. You know, I mean, I could think about mindfulness, and I could meditate, and I could try to journal and stuff, but without some framework, it was very hard for me to put anything into place. I grew up without religion, really, in my upbringing. I don't really have anything to kind of fall back on. And so I was really struggling, and I was listening to this podcast about happiness, and someone said the word stoicism, and I was like, I didn't even know what that was. I wrote it down. And after the podcast, I Googled it and started doing a deep dive into the philosophy. And it turns out kind of was tailor-made for this time of the world, right? It was started 2,500 years ago in Greece, migrated to Rome, where it kind of became more of a philosophy of practice. It's less of a kind of a Socrates kind of pen and ink philosophy where there's a lot of writing and a lot of talking. It's more like, what do you do in life and how do you live a life of virtue and how do you live a life of meaning, basically? And so I started doing some research, and what really struck me was the basic premise of Stoicism, to sum it up simply, is you can't control what happens to you in life, but you can control how you react to it.
Your response, yeah.
Yeah. All about response. And that really intellectually resonated with me because I always felt like, you know, we often, you know, respond to things in a way that makes it seem like we're upset that we can't control something, but we don't have any control over it anyway. So we end up responding in a way that detracts from our own enjoyment of something or ability to deliver on something when it's in kind of an irrational response. It's like, I'm upset that the economy is the way it is, and so I can't move forward with this. Well, the economy is what it is. Like, you can't control that. You have to figure out, how do you operate within the parameters of what it actually exists? And so it's a very grounded theory of, you know, the world is made up into things you can control and things you can't control, simply. And what you can
step one of AA, right?
Yeah, step one. Yeah, very. It's a little
some recognition.
Yeah, it's a little serenity prayer kind of. You know, being able to figure out, like, you know, what I can control and can't control, and the wisdom to understand, you know, to know the difference, right? And so, and the wisdom of knowing the difference is actually part of the challenge. The opportunity here is to focus on yourself, because the only thing that you can control is you, and you can control your perceptions, your reactions, your feelings, your desires, how you show up, what you can't control is what other people do, what other things that happen. They're going to do what they do. And the only thing you can do is figure out, how do I react when it happens? And I love that sort of basic concept, because it puts the onus on you to decide, you know, how do you show up? You know, what are you looking at? Is the glass half full or half empty? I don't know. It's up to you.
You realize it's all your choice, too.
It's all your choice. Yeah.
I always love the idea that something's going to happen right here in this room, and I'll look at it and say, well, that's a wonderful thing. And you can look at the exact same thing. That's terrible, right? So, yeah. Again, 100% on you and me to decide what we want to do with what just happened.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit of an antidote for today's climate, because, you know, we've gotten very hooked on people joining the tribe or not. Or being a part of a certain
thought
process.
Black and white, right?
It's very black and white, right? And it's like, if you don't think the way that I do, then you're dead to me, kind of a thing. And the stoicism is sort of the antithesis of that, in the sense that everyone's an individual and everyone has the power to think and reason on their own and make their own decisions about how they want to live and what they see.
Getting and crazy now, Ken.
Yeah, no, I know. It's exactly. It's like
what?
It's like the ultimate personal power sort of theory that, hey, you know, I have free will to decide what I see and what I do and how I react. And it's not for you or anybody else to tell me what I should think or not think. And I think we could use a lot more of that now and respect the fact that people see things differently. People have different perceptions. They have different world experiences. They have different worldviews.
And we all have a different set of filters.
And rather than
8 billion unique people walking
exactly,
around.
And be respectful of that by treating each individual as a reasoning being and knowing that, hey, you may think they're wrong, but they have a reason for thinking what they do. So there's just a lot of things about it that really appealed to me. And I started applying it in the veteran transition work that I was doing, because what I found is that veterans in transition were dealing with a ton of uncertainty and a ton of anxiety about entering this new world. And a lot of it came down to just, A, figure out like what is truly important to you. So it's not just getting a job. It's about finding your purpose. And B, you know, focusing on, rather than drinking from the fire hose and focusing on all these opportunities, prioritize what's important to you, focus on the things you can control, and allow yourself, you know, to move through the process, which will include some failure, right? I wrote this short book called The Stoic Transition a couple of years ago. One of the chapters is, you know, failure is a gift. A lot of the military and entrepreneurs, I think, when they start, think, oh, you know, if I fail, failure is terrible. Like, I don't want to fail. Failure is like the last thing you want to do.
Well, that gets baked into
it
us
does.
As kids in school, right? I mean, right. There's the pass, fail, ABC, right? I mean, that's,
right.
Yeah.
Well, the idea that what's the antithesis of failure is success. Actually, that's not true. Failure is a iterative process of learning, and you get better every time.
Right, the invention of the light bulb idea, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think for the military, for veterans, I think that's a scary process. The idea that they wouldn't have it all buttoned up, know exactly what they're going to do and achieve their next mission, which is their career and their personal life. Like, you know, I keep telling them, well, civilians, we fail all the time because we don't have it mapped out. We're just showing up every day and trying to make it work, right? So I think Stoicism is an interesting philosophy for that process. And then as I started getting into that, I started digging deeper about how it could be a tool for helping you regulate your emotions and move through life more effectively, build more internal resilience. And so I wrote a second book called The Stoic Edge, which is another 100-page short sort of guidebook in terms of how you can apply Stoicism to procrastination, imposter syndrome, anger, shame, guilt, you know, facing mortality. And, you know, they're just little primers for how to start to think about these things. It's not the final answer. It's just the beginning.
Yes, yes. Well, I love it. I'm very much into everything you're talking about here. I'm still trying to figure it all out,
yeah,
right?
Well, we all are.
Yes,
actually.
Yeah, it's a journey for sure.
Yeah.
A lot of this idea of, I mean, what just keeps showing up for me is, back to you, you own it, but you got to be conscious too, right? You got to actually wake up to the world and go, okay, I'm actually paying attention to what's going on and not just operating out of my, standard habits and all that kinds of
stuff.
Yeah,
which is why my journaling is such a big part of the Stoic practice. And actually the Marcus Aurelius, who wrote this, actually wrote a journal called Meditations, very famous book and widely read, was actually his personal journal that he kept, I'm assuming by his bedside, and he'd write it at night before he went to bed. I don't know. Maybe it was in the morning. I don't really know. But it was his personal journal. It wasn't really meant for publication. It was just for him, and it survived through the ages and was published. And, you know, Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of Rome, probably the most powerful man, you know, on earth at the time. And it was, and the medications is really about his daily struggle to deal with, you know, his subjects that were, you know, pissing him off and irritating him and his kids and, you know, all the challenges of like, you know, I want to stay in bed today and I don't want to get up and do my job. Oh, you know, but I was made for this job, so I have to get out of bed. And of course I want to do that because this is my purpose in life. And all the things he goes through in order to maintain his role as a Stoic emperor, which means that an emperor who's going to rule with virtue and not with ego, you know, and try to be the last of, and he wasn't, I think historians say, the last of the good emperors, because he was really mindful of the fact that, you know, I could do whatever I want, but what I want to do is I want to rule with wisdom, with courage, with justice, and with temperance. Those four kind of
virtues. Use a little bit of that today, yeah.
Yeah, and I so Marcus Aurelius stuff, even if you just go buy Meditations and read that, it's very easy reading, and it's such an interesting kind of snippet or view of, you know, the Roman emperor writing his notes to himself about how hard it is to be alive, how hard it is to deal with other people, how hard it is to just, like, get out of bed, like, this normal stuff that we all do.
Yeah, that we're all facing every day, yeah. Right?
So it puts things a little bit in perspective.
Yeah. The world hasn't changed that much, right?
No, it really hasn't. It's sort of the human condition, you know, which I think really something that I love to know that, hey, you think about, like, I'm not alone. Like, I know this is, like, normal. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book, The Stoic Edge, was that all these things that I faced in my life, you know, problems with childhood trauma and anger and shame and all this stuff, like, everyone's got some form of that, right? And these are universal things. So I tell a lot of my own story in it in order to kind of be transparent, to kind of allow people to relate to it. And I thought, you know, if I'm not going to be transparent in my own experience, I shouldn't write the book. But these are universal things, and that's the beauty of the philosophy. It's something to keep you present and to practice, just like mindfulness,
yep,
or anything else. You know, it's something you just have to do regularly. And I'm an imperfect practitioner. I don't always do it. My wife often says, you need a Stoic moment.
You know? It's good to have someone to remind you. Yeah. Usually our wives are good at that.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, because something you just said, I think, is, like, really important. Somehow I think we're in our own little world here, and we think we're the only ones struggling with all this good stuff. And quite honestly, everybody, I always think about that. I'm just looking at a crowd of people. I go, every single person here is dealing with something. Yeah, I guarantee you.
Absolutely.
If you're not, then, man, God bless you.
I think that's one of the things I talk to my son a lot about, you know, what I call the Instagram effect, which is, you know, the envy that comes out of looking at people's curated lives. And we now have technology in our pocket where you can bring other people's perfect lives into your life, scrolling endlessly, yep, and habitually, you know, dopamine flowing. And what it does is it kind of makes you think that, you know, oh, your life's crappy compared to these, right? But those are all fake, you know, visions of other people's lives, right? And their life is the same as your life, right? They've just got a great filter on it, and they've been able to put it together in a way that's designed.
It's got a good marketing program.
Yeah, designed to make you feel envious and designed to make you ultimately feel unhappy with yourself. Don't fall into that. Like, you know, the Stoics would say, your life is your own and it's here and it's right now, right? One of the Stoic concepts is amor fati, which is love your fate. And what it means is basically love where you are today. It may suck today, but love that, because that is a part of the process of learning and growing stronger and teaching you something about how tomorrow will be better.
Well, I started a gratitude journal next to my bed, because regardless how bad something might seem, I guarantee you there's some really good things going on too. If you just stop and look, I mean, the fact that you're sitting there writing something and breathing and probably healthy, whatever. I mean, there's always so many things you can look at. I go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What am I complaining about over here?
Yeah. And I think, you know, to get back to the mortality discussion we had earlier a little bit, the Stoics are great on death. And I say that, you know, they've got this concept called memento mori, which is remember you are mortal. And the idea of that is that, you know, remember that today could be your last day. And so make sure you balance your books, say what you need to say, live your life today as if it is your last day, and you will leave nothing unturned.
That is a good practice.
And that's a great—
Somehow we like live in this fantasy that somehow this is a keep on going and keep on going, and yeah, that is not the reality.
There's that, and the other flip side of that is that everybody lives for tomorrow. Like, even the way we retire, you know, the way we save for retirement in this country, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to work hard until we're 65, and then we're going to try to enjoy the fruits of everything we've done. And by that time, maybe you're too old to do half the things that you wanted to do, right? It's a little bit upside down.
Yep.
So the idea that it will get better when we get there, I think is, which I've always been, like everybody, you know, had struggled with, like, oh, if I just do that, or if I just sell my
success
company,
is over there, right?
Yeah, if
always
I just make this amount of money, but whatever. And at the end of the day, you get there and you're still unhappy and now you're looking for something else. It really comes down to understanding that there is no there. There is today. There is right now, right? And so if you're not happy right now, you're wasting precious time that you will never get back. And that might be your last moments. You just don't know. And of course, back in, you know, 130 AD, you know, death was more omnipresent than it is today, obviously. The notion still holds true that the only thing that's guaranteed is the present. So I love that too. It keeps you very mindful about thinking about, like, today's Monday, having a great conversation. There's nowhere else I'd rather be than right here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Otherwise, you're just spinning up something, right?
100%. Yeah.
Wow. Good stuff. Believe it or not, we're coming to the end here.
All right.
What's the big idea? Ken, you've shared some amazing things. I love the backstory because it talks, I mean, I guess just people a real sense for why you're doing what you're doing today and helping all these folks. What's the big idea? What's like the one thing you want people to remember out of this conversation?
I guess the big idea is to show up, right? To realize that life is now. Don't put it off till tomorrow. There are many, many people who need help. There are many of us who are capable of helping, and you can help in whatever way you want. There's no one way to do it. But I think that the more that those of us who produce and create can create the opportunities to give back and to help the community in whatever way that you can is part of the living a stoic life. Just to get back to Stoicism for a sec, Stoics were very big on community. You know, Marcus Aurelius said, you know, what's bad for the hive is bad for the bee, right? So if the hive is not thriving, the bee is not thriving. So if your community is not thriving, you really aren't thriving, even though you drive your nice car and it looks like you're doing well. But if the community's not doing well, then you're really not doing as well as you think you are. And so
you are connected in, yes.
Yeah, you really are. We're all interconnected. So I would just say the big idea is if you're thinking about volunteering, go volunteer. Like, don't put it off another day.
Yep. Not sure if this is the last one or not. So get to it.
Exactly.
Well, Ken, I appreciate you coming in and sharing all that good stuff. And yeah, and I appreciate you going on the journey. I've been on a bit of a journey like that myself, and it pays off. So hopefully this inspires other people to explore themselves a little bit and figure out who they are in the world and bring more meaning and impact to the work that they're doing. So
I hope so.
Thank you very much for coming in
today.
You're
welcome. Thank you.
Well, that's our show for the day. And if you enjoyed it, please subscribe, comment, and most importantly, share the podcast with a friend. Again, special thanks to our collaborative community of San Diego business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Be Local, Business for Good, and Cause San Diego. We're all using the influence of business to positively impact our very own community of San Diego. I'm Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership saying, till next time, go do what you do. Go do what you do best, for we're all counting on you.